puzzle. In this case, the jigsaw puzzle of a past that didn't quite make sense anymore. Viracocha was part of that same puzzle. All the legends said his capital had been at Tiwanaku. The ruins of this great and ancient city lay across the border in Bolivia, in an area known as the Colao, 12 miles south of Lake Titicaca. We could get there, I calculated, in a couple of days, via Lima and La Paz. Chapter 8, The Lake at the Roof of the World. La Paz, the capital city of Bolivia, nestles in the uneven bottom of a spectacular hole in the ground, more than 2 miles above sea level. This plunging ravine, thousands of feet deep, was carved in some primeval age by a tremendous downrush of water that carried with it an abrasive tide of loose rocks and rubble. Provided by nature with such an apocalyptic setting, La Paz possesses a unique, though slightly sleazy charm. With its narrow streets, dark-walled tenements, imposing cathedrals, garish cinemas, and hamburger bars open till late, it generates an atmosphere of quirky intrigue, which is oddly intoxicating. It's hard going for the pedestrian, however, unless equipped with lungs like bellows, because the whole of the central district is built up and down the sides of precipitous hills. La Paz Airport is almost 5,000 feet higher than the city itself, on the edge of the Altiplano, the cold rolling uplands that are the dominant topographical feature of this region. Santa and I landed there well after midnight on a delayed flight from Lima. In the drafty arrivals hall, we were offered coca tea in little plastic cups as a prophylactic against altitude sickness. After considerable delay and exertion, we extracted our luggage from customs, hailed an ancient American-made taxi, and clanked and rattled down towards the dim yellow lights of the city far below. Rumors of a cataclysm. Around 4 o'clock the next afternoon, we set off for Lake Titicaca in a rented jeep, fought our way through the capital's incomprehensible permanent rush hour traffic jams, then drove up out of the skyscrapers and slums into the wide, clear horizons of the Altiplano. At first, still close to the city, our route took us through a zone of bleak suburbs and sprawling shanty towns, where the sidewalks were lined with auto repair shops and scrapyards. The more distance we put between ourselves and La Paz, however, the more attenuated the settlements became, until almost all signs of human habitation ceased. The empty, treeless, undulating savannas, distantly bordered by the snow-covered peaks of the Cordillera Real, created an unforgettable spectacle of natural beauty and power. But there was also a feeling of otherworldliness about this place, which seemed to float above the clouds, like an enchanted kingdom. Although our ultimate destination was Tiwanaku, we were aiming that night for the town of Copacabana, on a promontory near the southern end of Lake Titicaca. To reach it, we had to cross a neck of water by improvised car ferry at the fishing town of Tiquine. Then, with dusk descending, we followed the main highway, now little more than a narrow and uneven track, up a series of steep hairpin bends and onto the shoulder of a mountain spur. From this point, a contrasting panorama unfolded. The dark, dark waters of the lake below appeared to lie at the edge of a limitless ocean, drowned in somber shadows. And yet the jagged peaks of the snow-capped mountains in the distance were still drenched in dazzling sunlight. From the very beginning, Lake Titicaca seemed to me a special place. I knew that it lay some 12,500 feet above sea level, that the frontier between Peru and Bolivia passed through it, that it covered an area of 3,200 square miles and was 138 miles long by about 70 miles wide. I also knew it was deep, reaching almost 1,000 feet in places, and had a puzzling geological history. Here are the mysteries and some of the solutions that have been proposed. 1. Though now more than 2 miles above sea level, the area around Lake Titicaca is littered with millions upon millions of fossilized seashells. This suggests that at some stage the whole of the Altiplano was forced upwards from the seabed, perhaps as part of the general terrestrial rising that formed South America as a whole. In the process, great quantities of ocean water, together with countless myriads of living marine creatures, were scooped up and suspended among the Andean ranges. This is thought to have happened not more recently than about 100 million years ago. 2. Paradoxically, despite the mighty antiquity of this event, Lake Titicaca has retained, until the present day, a marine ichthyofauna. In other words, though now located hundreds of miles from any ocean, its fish and crustacea feature many oceanic rather than freshwater types. Surprising creatures brought to the surface in fishermen's nets have included examples of hippocampus, the seahorse. In addition, as one authority has pointed out, the various species of Aloquestes, Hyalella inermis, etc., and other examples of marine fauna, leave no doubt that this lake in other periods was much saltier than today, or more accurately, that the water which formed it was from the sea, and that it was dammed up and locked in the Andes when the continent rose. 3. So much, then, for the events which may have created Lake Titicaca in the first place. Since its formation, this great interior sea and the Altiplano itself have undergone several other drastic and dramatic changes. Of these, by far the most noticeable is that the lake's extent appears to have fluctuated enormously, indicated by the existence of an ancient strand line visible on much of the surrounding terrain. Puzzlingly, this strand line is not level, but slopes markedly from north to south over a considerable horizontal distance. At the northernmost point surveyed, it is as much as 290 feet higher than Titicaca. Some 400 miles further south, it is 274 feet lower than the present level of the lake. From this and much other evidence, geologists have deduced that the Altiplano is still gradually rising, but in an unbalanced manner, with greater altitudes being attained in the northern part and lesser in the southern. The process involved here is thought to have less to do with changes in the level of Titicaca's waters themselves, although such changes have certainly occurred, than with changes in the level of the whole terrain in which the lake is situated. 4. Much harder to explain in such terms, however, given the very long time periods major geological transformations are supposed to require, is irrefutable evidence that the city of Tiwanaku was once a port, complete with extensive docks, positioned right on the shore of Lake Titicaca. The problem is that Tiwanaku's ruins are now marooned about 12 miles south of the lake, and more than 100 feet higher than the present shoreline. In the period since the city was built, it therefore follows that one of two things must have happened. Either the level of the lake has fallen greatly, or the land on which Tiwanaku stands has risen comparably. 5. Either way, it is obvious that there have been massive and traumatic physical changes. Some of these, such as the rise of the Altiplano from the floor of the ocean, certainly took place in remote geological ages, before the advent of human civilization. Others are not nearly so ancient, and must have occurred after the construction of Tiwanaku. The question, therefore, is this. When was Tiwanaku built? The orthodox historical view is that the ruins cannot possibly be dated much earlier than AD 500. An alternative chronology also exists, however, which, although not accepted by the majority of scholars, seems more in tune with the scale of the geological upheavals that have occurred in this region. Based on the mathematical astronomical calculations of Professor Arthur Poznanski of the University of La Paz and of Professor Rolf Mueller, who also challenged the official dating of Machu Picchu, it pushes the main phase of construction at Tiwanaku back to 15,000 BC. This chronology also indicates that the city later suffered immense destruction in a phenomenal natural catastrophe around the 11th millennium BC, and thereafter rapidly became separated from the lakeshore. We shall be reviewing Poznanski's and Mueller's findings in Chapter 11, findings which suggest that the great Andean city of Tiwanaku flourished during the last ice age, in the deep, dark, moonless midnight of prehistory. Chapter 9. Once and Future King. During my travels in the Andes, I had several times reread a curious variant of the mainstream tradition of Viracocha. In this variant, which was from the area around Lake Titicaca known as the Colao, the deity civilizing hero had been named Tunupa. Tunupa appeared on the altiplano in ancient times, coming from the north with five disciples. A white man, of august presence, blue-eyed and bearded, he was sober, puritanical, and preached against drunkenness, polygamy, and war. After traveling great distances through the Andes, where he created a peaceful kingdom and taught men all the arts of civilization, Tunupa was struck down and grievously wounded by a group of jealous conspirators. They put his blessed body in a boat of Totora rush and set it adrift on Lake Titicaca. There he sailed away with such speed that those who had tried so cruelly to kill him were left behind in terror and astonishment, for this lake has no current. The boat came to the shore at Cochamarca, where today is the River Desaguadero. Indian tradition asserts that the boat struck the land with such force it created the River Desaguadero, which before then did not exist. And on the water so released, the holy body was carried many leagues away to the sea coast at Arica. Boats, water, and salvation. There are many curious parallels here to the story of Osiris, the ancient Egyptian high god of death and resurrection. The fullest account of the original myth defining this mysterious figure is given by Plutarch, and says that after bringing the gifts of civilization to his people, teaching them all manner of useful skills, abolishing cannibalism and human sacrifice, and providing them with their first legal code, Osiris left Egypt and traveled about the world to spread the benefits of civilization to other nations as well. He never forced the barbarians he encountered to accept his laws, preferring instead to argue with them and to appeal to their reason. It is also recorded that he passed on his teachings to them by means of hymns and songs, accompanied by musical instruments. While he was gone, however, he was plotted against by 72 members of his court, led by his brother-in-law Set. On his return, the conspirators invited him to a banquet, where a splendid coffer of wood and gold was offered as a prize to any guest who could fit into it exactly. Osiris did not know that the coffer had been constructed precisely to his body measurements. As a result, when the assembled guests tried, one by one, to get into it, they failed. Osiris lay down comfortably inside. Before he had time to get out, the conspirators rushed forward, nailed the lid tightly closed, and sealed even the cracks with molten lead so that there would be no air. The coffer was then thrown into the Nile. It had been intended that it should sink, but it floated rapidly away, drifting for a considerable distance until it reached the sea coast. At this point, the goddess Isis, wife of Osiris, intervened. Using all the great magic for which she was renowned, she found the coffer and concealed it in a secret place. However, her evil brother Set, out hunting in the marshes, discovered the coffer, opened it, and in a mad fury cut the royal corpse into 14 pieces, which he scattered throughout the land. Once more, Isis set off to save her husband. She made a small boat of papyrus reeds, coated with pitch, and embarked on the Nile in search of the remains. When she had found them, she worked powerful spells to reunite the dismembered parts of the body so that it resumed its old form. Thereafter, in an intact and perfect state, Osiris went through a process of stellar rebirth to become god of the dead and king of the underworld, from which place, legend had it, he occasionally returned to earth in the guise of a mortal man. Although there are huge differences between the traditions, it is bizarre that Osiris in Egypt and Tunupa Viracocha in South America should have had all the following points in common. Both were great civilizers. Both were conspired against. Both were struck down. Both were sealed inside a container or vessel of some kind. Both were then cast into water. Both drifted away on a river. Both eventually reached the sea. Are such parallels to be dismissed as coincidences? Or could there be some underlying connection? Reed boats of Suriki. The air was alpine cold, and I was sitting on the front of a motor launch doing about 20 knots across the icy waters of Lake Titicaca. The sky above was clear blue, reflecting aquamarine and turquoise tints inshore, and the vast body of the lake, glinting in copper and silver tones, seemed to stretch away forever. The passages in the legends that spoke of vessels made of reeds needed to be followed up, because I knew that boats of Totora rush were a traditional form of transport on this lake. However, the ancient skills required to build craft of this type had atrophied in recent years, and we were now headed towards Suriki, the one place where they were still properly made. On Suriki Island, in a small village close to the lakeshore, I found two elderly Indians making a boat from bundled Totora rushes. The elegant craft, which appeared to be nearly complete, was approximately 15 feet long. It was wide amidships, but narrow at either end, with a high curving prow and stern. I sat down for a while to watch. The more senior of the two builders, who wore a brown felt hat over a curious peaked woolen cap, repeatedly braced his bare left foot against the side of the vessel to give additional leverage as he pulled and tightened the cords that held the bundles of reeds in place. From time to time, I noticed that he rubbed a length of cord against his own perspiring brow, thus moistening it to increase its adhesion. The boat, surrounded by chickens and occasionally investigated by a shy, browsing alpaca, stood amid a litter of discarded rushes in the backyard of a ramshackle farmhouse. It was one of several I was able to study over the next few hours, and though the setting was unmistakably Andean, I found myself repeatedly overtaken by a sense of déjà vu from another place and another time. The reason was that the Totora vessels of Suriki were virtually identical, both in the method of construction and in finished appearance, to the beautiful craft fashioned from papyrus reeds in which the pharaohs had sailed the Nile thousands of years previously. In my travels in Egypt, I had examined the images of many such vessels painted on the walls of ancient tombs. It sent a tingle down my spine to see them now so colorfully brought to life on an obscure island on Lake Titicaca, even though my research had partially prepared me for this coincidence. I knew that no satisfactory explanation had ever been given for how such close and richly detailed similarities of boat design could occur in two such widely separated places. Nevertheless, in the words of one authority in ancient navigation who had addressed himself to this conundrum, here was the same compact shape, peaked and raised at both ends, with rope lashings running from the deck right round the bottom of the boat, all in one piece. Each straw was placed with maximum precision to achieve perfect symmetry and streamlined elegance, while the bundles were so tightly lashed that they look like gilded logs bent into a clog-shaped peak fore and aft. The reed boats of the ancient Nile and the reed boats of Lake Titicaca, the original design of which local Indians insisted had been given to them by the Viracocha people, had other points in common. Both, for example, were equipped with sails, mounted on peculiar, two-legged, straddled masts. Both had also been used for the long-distance transport of exceptionally heavy building materials, obelisks and gargantuan blocks of stone, bound for the temples of Giza and Luxor and Abydos on the one hand, and for the mysterious edifices of Tiwanaku on the other. In those far-off days, before Lake Titicaca became more than 100 feet shallower, Tiwanaku had stood at the water's edge, overlooking a vista of awesome and sacred beauty. Now the great port, capital city of Viracocha himself, lay lost amid eroded hills and empty, windswept plains. Road to Tiwanaku. After returning from Suriki to the mainland, we drove our hired jeep across those plains, raising a cloud of dust. Our route took us through the towns of Pukarani and Laha, populated by stolid Aymara Indians, who walked slowly in the narrow cobbled streets and sat placidly in the little sunlit plazas. Were these people the descendants of the builders of Tiwanaku, as the scholars insisted? Or were the legends right? had the ancient city been the work of foreigners, with godlike powers, who had settled here long ages ago. Chapter 10. The City at the Gate of the Sun. The early Spanish travelers who visited the ruined Bolivian city of Tiwanaku at around the time of the conquest were impressed by the sheer size of its buildings and by the atmosphere of mystery that clung to them. "I asked the natives whether these edifices were built in the time of the Inca," wrote the chronicler Pedro Cieza de León. "They laughed at the question, affirming that they were made long before the Inca reign, and that they had heard from their forebears that everything to be seen there appeared suddenly, in the course of a single night." Meanwhile, another Spanish visitor of the same period recorded a tradition which said that the stones had been lifted miraculously off the ground. They were carried through the air to the sound of a trumpet. Not long after the conquest, a detailed description of the city was written by the historian Garcilaso de la Vega. No looting for treasure or for building materials had yet taken place, and though ravaged by the tooth of time, the site was still magnificent enough to take his breath away. "We must now say something about the large and almost incredible buildings of Tiwanaku. There is an artificial hill of great height, built on stone foundations so that the earth will not slide. There are gigantic figures carved in stone. These are much worn, which shows their great antiquity. There are walls, the stones of which are so enormous, it is difficult to imagine what human force could have put them in place. And there are the remains of strange buildings, the most remarkable being stone portals hewn out of solid rock. These stand on bases anything up to 30 feet long, 15 feet wide, and 6 feet thick, base and portal being all of one piece. How, and with the use of what tools or implements, massive works of such size could be achieved, are questions which we are unable to answer, nor can it be imagined how such enormous stones could have been brought here." That was in the 16th century. More than 400 years later, at the end of the 20th century, I shared Garcilaso's puzzlement. Scattered around Tiwanaku, in defiance of the looters who had robbed the site of so much in recent years, were monoliths so big and cumbersome yet so well cut that they almost seemed to be the work of super beings. Sunken Temple. Like a disciple at the feet of his master, I sat on the floor of the sunken temple and looked up at the enigmatic face which all the scholars of Tiwanaku believed was intended to represent Viracocha. Untold centuries ago, unknown hands had carved this likeness into a tall pillar of red rock. Though now much eroded, it was the likeness of a man at peace with himself. It was the likeness of a man of power. He had a high forehead and large, round eyes. His nose was straight, narrow at the bridge, but flaring towards the nostrils. His lips were full. His distinguishing feature, however, was his stylish and imposing beard, which had the effect of making his face broader at the jaws than at the temples. Looking more closely, I could see that the sculptor had portrayed a man whose skin was shaved all around his lips, with the result that his moustache began high on his cheeks, roughly parallel with the end of his nose. From there it curved extravagantly down beside the corners of his mouth, forming an exaggerated goatee at the chin, and then followed his jawline back to his ears. Above and below the ears, on the side of the head, were carved odd representations of animals. Or perhaps it would be better to describe these carvings as representations of odd animals, because they looked like big, clumsy, prehistoric mammals with fat tails and club feet. There were other points of interest. For example, the stone figure of Viracocha had been sculpted with the hands and arms folded, one below the other, over the front of a long, flowing robe. On each side of this robe appeared the sinuous form of a snake, coiling upwards from ground to shoulder level. And as I looked at this beautiful design, the original of which had perhaps been embroidered on rich cloth, The picture that came into my mind was of Vera Kocha as a wizard or a sorcerer, a bearded, Merlin-like figure, dressed in weird and wonderful clothes, calling down fire from heaven. The temple in which the Vera Kocha pillar stood was open to the sky and consisted of a large rectangular pit, like a swimming pool, dug out 6 feet below ground level. Its floor, about 40 feet long by 30 feet wide, was composed of hard, flat gravel. Its strong vertical walls were formed from precisely dressed ashlar blocks of varying sizes, laid closely against one another, without mortar in the joints, and interspersed with taller, rough-hewn stelae. A set of steps was let into the southern wall, and it was down these I had come when I had entered the structure. I walked several times around the figure of Vera Kocha, resting my fingers on the sun-warmed stone pillar, trying to guess its purpose. It was perhaps 7 feet tall, and it faced south, with its back to the old shoreline of Lake Titicaca, originally less than 600 feet away. Ranged out behind this central obelisk, furthermore, there were two others of smaller stature, possibly intended to represent Viracocha's legendary companions. All three figures, being severely, functionally vertical, cast clean-edged shadows as I gazed at them, for the sun was past its zenith. I sat down on the ground again and looked slowly all around the temple. Vera Kocha dominated it, like the conductor of an orchestra, and yet its most striking feature undoubtedly lay elsewhere. Lining the walls at various points and heights were dozens and dozens of human heads sculpted in stone. These were complete heads, protruding three-dimensionally out of the walls. There were several different and contradictory scholarly opinions as to their function. Pyramid. From the floor of the sunken temple, looking west, I could see an immense wall, into which was set an impressive geometrical gateway made of large slabs of stone. Silhouetted in this gateway by the afternoon sun was the figure of a giant. The wall, I knew, enclosed a parade ground-sized area called the Calasasia, a word in the local Aymara language meaning simply place of the upright standing stones, and the giant was one of the huge, time-worn pieces of sculpture referred to by Garcilaso de la Vega. I was eager to take a look at it, but for the moment my attention was diverted southwards, towards an artificial hill, 50 feet high, which lay almost directly ahead of me as I climbed the steps out of the sunken temple. The hill, which had also been mentioned by Garcilaso, was known as the Acapana Pyramid. Like the pyramids at Giza in Egypt, it was oriented with surprising precision towards the cardinal points. Unlike those pyramids, its ground plan was somewhat irregular. Nonetheless, it measured roughly 690 feet on each side, which meant that it was a hulking piece of architecture and the dominant edifice of Tiwanaku. I walked towards it now and spent some time strolling around it and clambering over it. Originally, it had been a clean-sided step pyramid of earth, faced with large andesite blocks. In the centuries since the conquest, however, it had been used as a quarry by builders from as far away as La Paz, with the result that only about 10% of its superb facing blocks now remained. What clues, what evidence had those nameless thieves carried off with them? As I climbed up the broken sides and around the deep grassy troughs in the top of the Acapana, I realized that the true function of the pyramid was probably never going to be understood. All that was certain was that it had not been merely decorative or ceremonial. On the contrary, it seemed almost as though it might have functioned as some kind of arcane device or machine. Deep within its bowels, archaeologists had discovered a complex network of zigzagging stone channels lined with fine ashlars. These had been meticulously angled and jointed to a tolerance of 1/50th of an inch, and had served to sluice water down from a large reservoir at the top of the structure, through a series of descending levels, to a moat that encircled the entire site, washing against the pyramid's base on its southern side. So much care and attention had been lavished on all this plumbing, so many man-hours of highly skilled and patient labor, that the Acapana made no sense unless it had been endowed with a significant purpose. A number of archaeologists I knew had speculated that this purpose might have been connected with a rain or river cult involving a primitive veneration of the powers and attributes of fast-flowing water. One sinister suggestion, which implied that the unknown technology of the pyramid might have had a lethal purpose, was derived from the meanings of the words hake and apana in the ancient Aymara language, still spoken hereabouts. Hake means people or men. Apana means to perish, probably by water. Thus, Akapana is a place where people perish. Another commentator, however, after making a careful assessment of all the characteristics of the hydraulic system, proposed a different solution, namely that the sluices had most probably been part of a processing technique, the use of flowing water for washing ores, perhaps. Gateway of the Sun. Leaving the western side of the enigmatic pyramid, I made my way towards the southwest corner of the enclosure known as the Kalasasia. I could see now why it had been called the place of the upright standing stones, for this was precisely what it was. At regular intervals in a wall composed of bulky trapezoidal blocks, huge dagger-like monoliths more than 12 feet high had been sunk hilt-first into the red earth of the Altiplano. The effect was of a giant stockade, almost 500 feet square, rising about twice as far above the ground as the sunken temple had been interred beneath it. Had the Kalasasia been a fortress then? Apparently not. Scholars now generally accepted that it functioned as a sophisticated celestial observatory. Rather than keeping enemies at bay, its purpose had been to fix the equinoxes and the solstices, and to predict, with mathematical precision, the various seasons of the year. Certain structures within its walls, and indeed the walls themselves, appeared to have been lined up to particular star groups and designed to facilitate measurement of the amplitude of the sun in summer, winter, autumn, and spring. In addition, the famous Gateway of the Sun, which stood in the northwest corner of the enclosure, was not only a world-class work of art, but was thought by those who had studied it to be a complex and accurate calendar carved in stone. The more one gets acquainted with the sculpture, the greater becomes one's conviction that the peculiar layout and pictorialism of this calendar cannot possibly have been the result merely of the ultimately unfathomable whim of an artist, but that its glyphs, deeply sensful, constitute the eloquent record of the observations and calculations of a scientist. The calendar could not have been drawn up and laid out in any other way than this. My background research had made me especially curious about the Gateway of the Sun, and indeed about the Kalasasia as a whole. This was so because certain astronomical and solar alignments, which we review in the next chapter, had made it possible to calculate the approximate period when the Kalasasia must originally have been laid out. These alignments suggested the controversial date of 15,000 BC, about 17,000 years ago. Chapter 11. Intimations of Antiquity. In his voluminous work, Tiwanaku, the Cradle of American Man, the late Professor Arthur Poznanski, a formidable German-Bolivian scholar whose investigations at the ruins lasted for almost 50 years, explains the archaeoastronomical calculations which led to his controversial redating of Tiwanaku. These, he says, were based solely and exclusively on the difference in the obliquity of the ecliptic of the period in which the Kalasasia was built and that which it is today. What exactly is the obliquity of the ecliptic, and why does it make Tiwanaku 17,000 years old? According to the dictionary definition, it is the angle between the plane of the Earth's orbit and that of the celestial equator, equal to approximately 23 degrees 27 minutes at present. To clarify this obscure astronomical notion, it helps to picture the Earth as a ship, sailing on the vast ocean of the heavens. Like all such vessels, be they planets or schooners, it rolls slightly with the swell that flows beneath it. Picture yourself on board that ship as it rolls, standing on the deck, gazing out to sea. You rise up on the crest of a wave and your visible horizon increases. You fall back into a trough and it decreases. The process is regular, mathematical, like the tick-tock of a great metronome, a constant, almost imperceptible nodding, perpetually changing the angle between yourself and the horizon. Now picture the Earth again. Floating in space, as every schoolchild knows, the axis of daily rotation of our beautiful blue planet lies slightly tilted away from the vertical in its orbit around the sun. From this, it follows that the terrestrial equator, and hence the celestial equator, which is merely an imaginary extension of the Earth's equator into the celestial sphere, must also lie at an angle to the orbital plane. That angle, at any one time, is the obliquity of the ecliptic. But because the Earth is a ship that rolls, its obliquity changes in a cyclical manner over very long periods. During each cycle of 41,000 years, the obliquity varies with the precision and predictability of a Swiss chronograph between 22.1 degrees and 24.5 degrees. The sequence in which one angle will follow another, as well as the sequence of all previous angles at any period of history, can be calculated by means of a few straightforward equations. These have been expressed as a curve on a graph, originally plotted out in Paris in 1911 by the International Conference of Ephemerids, and from this graph it is possible to match angles and precise historical dates with confidence and accuracy. Poznanski was able to date the Kalasasia because the obliquity cycle gradually alters the azimuth position of sunrise and sunset from century to century. By establishing the solar alignments of certain key structures that now looked out of true, he convincingly demonstrated that the obliquity of the ecliptic at the time of the building of the Kalasasia had been 23 degrees, 8 minutes, 48 seconds. When that angle was plotted on the graph drawn up by the International Conference of Ephemerids, it was found to correspond to a date of 15,000 BC. Of course, not a single orthodox historian or archaeologist was prepared to accept such an early origin for Tiwanaku, preferring, as noted in Chapter 8, to agree on the safe estimate of AD 500. During the years 1927 to 30, however, several scientists from other disciplines checked carefully Poznanski's astronomic archaeological investigations. These scientists, members of a high-powered team which also studied many other archaeological sites in the Andes, were Dr. Hans Ludendorff, then director of the Astronomical Observatory of Potsdam, Dr. Friedrich Becker of the Specula Vaticanica, and two other astronomers, Professor Dr. Arnold Kohlschutter of the University of Bonn and Dr. Rolf Müller of the Astrophysical Institute of Potsdam. At the end of their 3 years of work, the scientists concluded that Poznanski was basically right. They didn't concern themselves with the implications of their findings for the prevailing paradigm of history. They simply stated the observable facts about the astronomical alignments of various structures at Tiwanaku. Of these, the most important by far was that the Kalasasia had been laid out to conform with observations of the heavens made a very long time ago, much, much further back than AD 500. Poznanski's figure of 15,000 BC was pronounced to be well within the bounds of possibility. If Tiwanaku had indeed flourished so long before the dawn of history, what sort of people had built it, and for what purpose? Fish-garbed figures. There were two massive pieces of statuary inside the Kalasasia. One, a figure nicknamed Al-Frail, the friar, stood in the southwest corner. The other, towards the center of the eastern end of the enclosure, was the giant that I had observed from the sunken temple. Carved in red sandstone, worn and ancient beyond reckoning, Al-Frail stood about 6 feet high and portrayed a humanoid, androgynous being with massive eyes and lips. In its right hand it clutched something resembling a knife with a wavy blade like an Indonesian kris. In its left hand was an object like a hinged and case-bound book. From the top of this book, however, protruded a device which had been inserted into it as though into a sheath. From the waist down, the figure appeared to be clad in a garment of fish scales. and as though to confirm this perception, the sculpture had formed the individual scales out of rows and rows of small, highly stylized fish heads. This sign had been persuasively interpreted by Poznanski as meaning fish in general. It seemed, therefore, that El Frail was a portrayal of an imaginary or symbolic fishman. The figure was also equipped with a belt, sculpted with the images of several large crustaceans, so this notion seemed all the more probable. What had been intended? I had learned of one local tradition I thought might shed light on the matter. It was very ancient, and spoke of gods of the lake with fish tails, called Chulua and Umantua. In this, and in the fish-garbed figures, it seemed that there was a curious, out-of-place echo of Mesopotamian myths, which spoke strangely and at length about amphibious beings, endowed with reason, who had visited the land of Sumer in remote prehistory. The leader of these beings was named Oannes, or Uan. According to the Chaldean scribe Berosus, the whole body of Oannes was like that of a fish, and had under a fish's head another head, and also feet below, similar to those of a man subjoined to the fish's tail. His voice, too, and language was articulate and human, and a representation of him is preserved even to this day. When the sun set, it was the custom of this being to plunge again into the sea and abide all night in the deep, for he was amphibious. According to the traditions reported by Berosus, Oannes was above all a civilizer. In the daytime, he used to converse with men, but took no food at that season, and he gave them an insight into letters and sciences and every kind of art. He taught them to construct houses, to found temples, to compile laws, and explained to them the principles of geometrical knowledge. He made them distinguish the seeds of the earth, and showed them how to collect fruits. In short, he instructed them in everything which could tend to soften manners and to humanize mankind. From that time, so universal were his instructions, nothing has been added materially by way of improvement. The surviving images of the Oannes creatures I had seen on Babylonian and Assyrian reliefs clearly portrayed fish-garbed men. Fish scales formed the dominant motif on their garments, just as they did on those worn by El Frail. Another similarity was that the Babylonian figures held unidentified objects in both their hands. If my memory served me right, and I later confirmed that it did, these objects were by no means identical to those carried by El Frail. They were, however, similar enough to be worthy of note. The other great idol of the Colossea was positioned towards the eastern end of the platform, facing the main gateway, and was an imposing monolith of grey andesite, hugely thick, and standing about 9 feet tall. Its broad head rose straight up out of its hulking shoulders, and its slab-like face stared expressionlessly into the distance. It was wearing a crown or headband of some kind, and its hair was braided into orderly rows of long vertical ringlets which were most clearly visible at the back. The figure was also intricately carved and decorated across much of its surface, almost as though it were tattooed. Like El Frail, it was clad below the waist in a garment composed of fish scales and fish symbols, and also like El Frail, it held two unidentifiable objects in its hands. This time, the left-hand object looked more like a sheath than a case-bound book, and from it protruded a forked handle. The right-hand object was roughly cylindrical, narrow in the center where it was held, wider at the shoulders and at the base, and then narrowing again towards the top. It appeared to have several different sections or parts fitted over and into one another, but it was impossible to guess what it might represent. Images of extinct species. Leaving the fish-garbed figures, I came at last to the gateway of the sun, located in the northwest corner of the Colossea. It proved to be a freestanding monolith of grey-green andesite, about 12.5 feet wide, 10 feet high, and 18 inches thick, weighing an estimated 10 tons. perhaps best envisaged as a sort of Arc de Triomphe, though on a much smaller scale, it looked in this setting like a door connecting two invisible dimensions, a door between nowhere and nothing. The stonework was of exceptionally high quality, and authorities agreed that it was one of the archaeological wonders of the Americas. Its most enigmatic feature was the so-called calendar frieze carved into its eastern facade along the top of the portal. At its center, in an elevated position, this frieze was dominated by what scholars took to be another representation of Viracocha, but this time in his more terrifying aspect as the god-king who could call down fire from heaven. His gentle fatherly side was still expressed. Tears of compassion were running down his cheeks, but his face was set stern and hard. His tiara was regal and imposing, and in either hand he grasped a thunderbolt. In the interpretation given by Joseph Campbell, one of the 20th century's best-known students of myth, the meaning is that the grace that pours into the universe through the sun door is the same as the energy of the bolt that annihilates and is itself indestructible. I turned my head to right and left, slowly studying the remainder of the frieze. It was a beautifully balanced piece of sculpture, with three rows of eight figures, 24 in all, lined up on either side of the elevated central image. Many attempts, none of them particularly convincing, have been made to explain the assumed calendrical function of these figures. All that could really be said for sure was that they had a peculiar, bloodless, cartoon-like quality, and that there was something coldly mathematical, almost machine-like, about the way they seemed to march in regimented lines towards Viracocha. Some apparently wore bird masks. Others had sharply pointed noses, and each had in his hand an implement of the type the High God was himself carrying. The base of the frieze was filled with a design known as the meander, a geometrical series of step pyramid forms set in a continuous line and arranged alternately upside down and right side up, which was also thought to have had a calendrical function. On the third column from the right-hand side, and more faintly on the third column from the left-hand side too, I could make out a clear carving of an elephant's head, ears, tusks, and trunk. This was unexpected, since there are no elephants anywhere in the New World. There had been, however, in prehistoric times, as I was able to confirm much later, particularly numerous in the southern Andes, until their sudden extinction around 10,000 BC, had been members of a species called Cuvieronius, an elephant-like proboscid, complete with tusks and a trunk, uncannily similar in appearance to the elephants of the Gateway of the Sun. I stepped forward a few paces to take a closer look at these elephants. Each turned out to be composed of the heads of two crested condors placed throat to throat, the crests constituting the ears and the upper part of the neck, the tusks. The creatures thus formed still looked like elephants to me, perhaps because a characteristic visual trick the sculptors of Tiwanaku had employed again and again in their subtle and otherworldly art had been to use one thing to depict another. Thus an apparently human ear on an apparently human face might turn out to be a bird's wing. Likewise, an ornate crown might be composed of alternate fishes and condors' heads, an eyebrow, a bird's neck and head, the toe of a slipper, an animal's head, and so on. Members of the elephant family, formed out of condors' heads, therefore need not necessarily be optical illusions. On the contrary, such inventive composites would be perfectly in keeping with the overall artistic character of the frieze. Among the riot of stylized animal figures carved into the Gateway of the Sun were a number of other extinct species as well. I knew from my research that one of these had been convincingly identified by several observers as Toxodon, a three-toed amphibious mammal about 9 feet long and 5 feet high at the shoulder, resembling a short stubby cross between a rhino and a hippo. Like Cuvieronius, Toxodon had flourished in South America in the late Pliocene, 1.6 million years ago, and had died out at the end of the Pleistocene, about 12,000 years ago. To my eye, This looked like a striking corroboration for the astro-archaeological evidence that dated Tiwanaku to the end of the Pleistocene, and further undermined the orthodox historical chronology, which made the city only 1,500 years old, since Toxodon, presumably, could only have been modeled from life. It was therefore obviously a matter of some importance that no fewer than 46 Toxodon heads had been carved into the frieze of the Gateway of the Sun. Nor was this creature's ugly caricature confined only to the gateway. On the contrary, Toxodon had been identified on numerous fragments of Tiwanakan pottery. Even more convincingly, he had been portrayed in several pieces of sculpture which showed him in full three-dimensional glory. Moreover, representations of other extinct species had been found. The species included Chelidotherium, a diurnal quadruped, and Macrauchenia, an animal somewhat larger than the modern horse, with distinctive three-toed feet. Such images meant that Tiwanaku was a kind of picture book from the past, a record of bizarre animals, now deader than the dodo, expressed in everlasting stone. But the record-taking had come to an abrupt halt one day, and darkness had descended. This, too, was recorded in stone. The Gateway of the Sun, that surpassing work of art, had never been completed. Certain unfinished aspects of the frieze made it seem probable that something sudden and dreadful had happened, which had caused the sculptor, in the words of Poznanski, to drop his chisel forever at the moment when he was putting the final touches to his work. Chapter 12. The End of the Viracochas. We heard in Chapter 10 that Tiwanaku was originally built as a port on the shores of Lake Titicaca, when that lake was far wider and more than 100 feet deeper than it is today. Vast harbor constructions, piers and dikes, and even dumped cargoes of quarried stone at points beneath the old waterline leave no doubt that this must have been the case. Indeed, according to the unorthodox estimates of Professor Poznanski, Tiwanaku had been in active use as a port as early as 15,000 BC, the date he proposed for the construction of the Colossea, and had continued to serve as such for approximately another 5,000 years, during which great expanse of time its position in relation to the shore of Lake Titicaca hardly changed. Throughout this epoch, the principal harbor of the port city was located several hundred meters southwest of the Colossea, at a site now known as Pumapunku, literally the Puma Gate. Here Poznanski's excavations revealed two artificially dredged docks on either side of a true and magnificent pier or wharf, where hundreds of ships could at the same time take on and unload their heavy burdens. One of the construction blocks from which the pier had been fashioned still lay on site and weighed an estimated 440 tons. Numerous others weighed between 100 and 150 tons. Furthermore, many of the biggest monoliths had clearly been joined to each other by eye-shaped metal clamps. In the whole of South America, I knew, this masonry technique had been found only on Tiwanakan structures. The last time I had seen the characteristic notched depressions which proved its use had been on ruins on the island of Elephantina in the Nile in Upper Egypt. Equally thought-provoking was the appearance of the symbol of the cross on many of these ancient blocks, recurring again and again, particularly at the northern approach to Pumapunku. This symbol always took the same form, a double crucifix with pure, clean lines, perfectly balanced and harmonious, deeply recessed into the hard grey stone. Even according to orthodox historical chronology, these crosses were not less than 1,500 years old. In other words, they had been carved here by a people with absolutely no knowledge of Christianity, a full millennium before the arrival of the first Spanish missionaries on the Altiplano. Where, come to that, had the Christians obtained their crosses? Not only from the shape of the structure to which Jesus Christ was nailed, I thought, but from some much older source as well. Hadn't the ancient Egyptians, for example, used a hieroglyph very like a cross? The Ankh or Crux Ansata, to symbolize life, the breath of life, eternal life itself? Had that symbol originated in Egypt, or had it perhaps occurred elsewhere, earlier still? With such ideas chasing one another around my head, I walked slowly around Pumapunku. The extensive perimeter, which formed a rectangle several hundred feet long, outlined a low, pyramidal hill, much overgrown with tall grass. Dozens and dozens of hulking blocks lay scattered in all directions, tossed like matchsticks, Poznanski argued, in the terrible natural disaster that had overtaken Tiwanaku during the 11th millennium BC. This catastrophe was caused by seismic movements which resulted in an overflow of the waters of Lake Titicaca and in volcanic eruptions. It is also possible that the temporary increase in the level of the lake may have been caused in part by the breaking of the bulwarks on some of the lakes further to the north and situated at a greater altitude, thus releasing the waters, which descended toward Lake Titicaca in onrushing and unrestrainable torrents. Poznanski's evidence that a flood had been the agent of the destruction of Tiwanaku included the discovery of lacustrine flora, Paludistrina culminea, and Paludistrina andicola, Anchylus titicanensis, Planorbis titicanensis, etc., mixed in the alluvia with the skeletons of human beings who perished in the cataclysm, and the discovery of various skeletons of Orestius, fish of the family of the present Bogas, in the same alluvia which contain the human remains. In addition, fragments of human and animal skeletons had been found lying in chaotic disorder among wrought stones, utensils, tools, and an endless variety of other things. All of this has been moved, broken, and accumulated in a confused heap. Anyone who would dig a trench here, 2 meters deep, could not deny that the destructive force of water, in combination with brusque movements of the earth, must have accumulated those different kinds of bones, mixing them with pottery, jewels, tools, and utensils. Layers of alluvium cover the whole field of the ruins, and lacustrine sand mixed with shells from Titicaca, decomposed feldspar, and volcanic ashes have accumulated in the places surrounded by the walls. It had been a terrible catastrophe indeed that had overwhelmed Tiwanaku. And if Poznanski was right, it took place more than 12,000 years ago. Thereafter, though the floodwaters subsided, the culture of the Altiplano did not again attain a high point of development, but fell rather into a total and definitive decadence. Struggle and abandonment. This process was hastened by the fact that the earthquakes which had caused Lake Titicaca to engulf Tiwanaku were only the first of many upheavals in the area. These initially resulted in the lake swelling and overflowing its banks, but they soon began to have the opposite effect, slowly reducing Titicaca's depth and surface area. As the years passed, the lake continued to drain inch by inch, marooning the great city, remorselessly separating it from the waters which had previously played such a vital role in its economic life. At the same time, there was evidence that the climate of the Tiwanaku area had become colder and much less favorable for the growing of crops than had previously been the case. So much less favorable that today staples such as maize cannot ripen properly, and even potatoes come out of the ground stunted. Although it was difficult to piece together all the different elements of the complex chain of events that had occurred, it seemed that a period of calm had followed the critical moment of seismic disturbance which had temporarily flooded Tiwanaku. Then, slowly but surely, the climate worsened and became inclement. Finally, there ensued mass emigrations of the Andean peoples towards locations where the struggle for life would not be so arduous. It seems that the highly civilized inhabitants of Tiwanaku, remembered in local traditions as the Viracocha people, had not gone without a struggle. There was puzzling evidence from all over the Altiplano that agricultural experiments of an advanced and scientific nature had been carried out with great ingenuity and dedication to try to compensate for the deterioration of the climate. For example, recent research has demonstrated that astonishingly sophisticated analyses of the chemical compositions of many poisonous high-altitude plants and tubers had been undertaken by somebody in this region in the furthest antiquity. Such analyses, furthermore, had been coupled with the invention of detoxification techniques, which had rendered these otherwise nutritious vegetables harmless and edible. There was as yet no satisfactory explanation for the development of these detoxification processes, admitted David Brauman, associate professor of anthropology at Washington University. Likewise, in the same period,